TED Audio Collective.
Hi, I'm Debbie Millman. Canva is great for designing visual content for work, no matter what industry or department you work in. Nail your next presentation with Canva Presentations. Start with a professionally designed template and use it as a springboard for your design. It's a serious time saver. Time to present but can't be there in person? Enter Canva Talking Presentations. Record yourself presenting and add your talking head to your slides so your audience can watch your perfected presentation anywhere, anytime. Start designing today at canva.com. Designed for work.
This message comes from Apple Card. Earn up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase every day. Then grow it at 4.50% annual percentage yield when you open a savings account with Apple Card. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card subject to credit approval. Savings available to Apple Card owners subject to eligibility. Savings accounts provided by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, member FDIC. Terms apply.
This is Design Matters with Debbie Millman from DesignObserver.com. On this program, Debbie Millman talks with Irma Boom about her career and about the art and craft of her celebrated book designs.
What I make is always very intrinsic. The solution is already in the assignment. And I must say, you say all these wonderful words, but I think I'm an extremely bad designer.
What?
Here's Debbie Millman.
Irma Boom is a book designer. A really, really good one. We're talking 50 books in the permanent collection of the Museum of Modern Art. That's how good. Her books aren't just beautifully crafted objects. They're visual journeys. Sentences run off the page. Image and text play off each other. Pages dip and fold. Some are shredded, sliced, cut. Her magnum opus is a book celebrating a Dutch energy corporation's 100th birthday. It took her a year and a half to design, but over 3 years to prepare for. She went to shareholders' meetings and dug through the company's archives. One of her books, Weaving as Metaphor, was called the most beautiful book in the world. Did I mention she was the youngest person ever to get the acclaimed Gutenberg Award for graphic artists? Irma Boom, welcome to Design Matters.
Thank you.
So, Irma, the last line of your book, the architecture of the book, is the line, "The book is dead, long live the book." Why the contradiction?
It's a sentence from England. If the king dies, you say, "The king is dead, long live the king." So it's something which reverts to that, but also to this conversation where Massimo Vignelli, designers and book, triggered me by saying the book is dead. And he made me think of that. And so it's basically very good that he said it so many times that I thought about it and thought I have to write a statement why the book is not dead. The book is maybe dead, but it's more alive than ever. And so there is a moment that you can say the book is dead. And certainly, I think a few years ago when the internet was, of course, it's still big and will be bigger every second, but that people doubted if books were still valuable. And I think the book maybe was at some point dead, but it's certainly more alive than ever.
So when you actually said that on stage, I was in the audience. Massimo Vignelli was particularly, I don't know if cantankerous is the right word, but he was particularly vehement about the fact that the book was dead. He did keep saying it over and over. I don't know if he really believed it or if he was trying to egg you on, but it does seem to me that whenever I am interviewing designers that have had a specialty in books, or if I'm in the audience with people that are being interviewed or talking about books, every designer that I speak to feels that we are actually in a time where there's never been better design of books. that there is this opportunity now to do something that's never been done before, which is to truly help books be sold by the grand and sheer beauty of their making. Would you agree with that?
Well, what I think is interesting, if people say the book is dead, of course they tease me because I think the book is more alive than ever.
I agree.
And I think because of internet and social media, what all is flux and changes every moment you want to change content. And I think the book will gain or regain more value because of the frozen information of the book. So because it's a frozen information, I call it, I don't know if it's a good expression.
No, it's perfect. It's telegraphic.
And so you make a piece of work which is not changeable. And therefore, I think it becomes a container to reflect on. And I think that's an important thing. It is something what is like the SHV book. Imagine if we had made a DVD or a website, then it was already obsolete. It was already gone. And now the book is 18 years old. It's basically young, of course, but it's still a book where people refer to. And because of this book, this not changeable fact, I think that gives a value. And maybe because internet and iPads and etc. Is so part of our life. That's why I think of the renaissance of the book. So that something is a fact and is, yeah, not changeable. Maybe gets more value. Hopefully.
Well, I want to talk a little bit more, quite a lot more actually, about the SHV book. But I want to start a little bit before that. Let's start at the beginning. You were born in the Netherlands in 1960. And in 1979, you attended the AKI School of Fine Art in Enschede in Eastern Holland. But I understand that you originally wanted to be a painter. You were a fan of Ellsworth Kelly and Agnes Martin. What changed your mind? What made you decide to become a designer?
Well, I went to art school because I had this very romantic idea of becoming a painter and working in your studio all alone and creating all this wonderful stuff. But then I realized it's really hard to become a very good painter.
Really hard to become a really good anything.
That's true. But maybe I was missing something. There was a sort of necessity missing of actually doing making the paintings, to convince myself all the time to get to work. And it basically didn't work. And then I went to this liberal school, the Aki, as you mentioned. You could do photography or fashion or architecture. So you could walk around in the school. And at some point, I found this teacher who brought always suitcases with books to the school and would talk about it.
And that was Abe Kuipers?
That was Abe Kuipers. And so that's the person who I basically fell in love with. Not with him, of course, but with what he was saying, talking about books, why books have a specific presence, why are poetry books like this. He all talked about books and he would also read from the books. It was about form and content. It was so inspiring, I stayed.
At school, you were encouraged to do endless experiments. In fact, you've said it was a school where you could do anything that you liked. But then I read that you felt that your liberal education left you with a lack of technical know-how. Yet you seem to have turned that to your advantage in quite a unique way. You wrote in your book, because I didn't know all the technical things, if I had a solution in my head, I would just want it done like that. If they said it wasn't technically possible, I would just keep insisting. And I always found a way in the end. You must have driven people crazy. I can imagine your sort of steadfast belief, this can happen.
Exactly. And that's exactly what happened. And so, of course, you have to know things. But I really didn't know anything. At school, we only learned to conceptualize issues. So it was really interesting and I think very valuable, more valuable than learning skills. Learning skills you can do very fast in a practice. But I think the lack of this technical experience was in the big advantage. The stamp books from 87, 88 are a sample of that. And I drove people crazy. I was at some point forbidden to enter the print shop. I really had to ask permission before, because I worked at the government, so at the state design office, and it was a publishing house. So it was always the advantage to go immediately to the print shop, but at some point they wouldn't allow me anymore.
So when you would have a sense of what could be done, what gave you the sense that it could be realistically manifested? If somebody would say to you, no, this can't happen, what would give you the confidence that it could actually happen?
So what I did and what I still do is I make always models of the books I'm making. So I make them in mini version, but also in actual size. And I think if I can make it with my hands, then a machine can do it much better. So for me, it's always convincing to show the binder and printers my model. And that's always very roughly made. If I can do it by hand, a machine can do it 1,000 times better. And of course, it worked, but with a lot of energy. It cost me always a lot of energy to get it done.
When you finally started reading about typography, I understand that you realized that everything that you were doing with typography was quote unquote forbidden. And you stated, maybe if I learned how to use typography at art school, my work would have been completely different. And I've been really thinking about your statement, that statement, and wondering how it would have been different. Do you feel like it would have been more conventional? Do you feel that you would have imagined less? I'm very intrigued by the idea of what we're taught and what we're not taught and how that influences how we approach what we do.
Yeah, so again, I think at art school that I learned to conceptualize things, that it was the development of the individual. And to know about typography, of course, is important. And we learned a bit about it, but to actually do it and not have the burden of you cannot use so many characters on a line or something like that. It was totally free and open. So basically, I think the school I went to, it was a liberal school. So also even for graphic design, it was very free and open. And I was only thinking, what do I want to make and how can I achieve it? That's what I want to do.
I guess it's a tough question to ask. How do you imagine it would have been had you learned more methodically or with more rigor in terms of what you realized you could or couldn't do at that moment? But it's hard for me to imagine that you wouldn't have rebelled in the face of those rules anyway. I'm wondering if that would have, I mean, it's a tough question to sort of that kind of conjecture. But I can't help but have fun thinking about it.
I also don't know how. I don't know. But it is also something, if I work, of course, if you make books, you make a reproduction. So you make a large print run.
And you love large print runs.
That's why you make a book. So it's a democratic thing. It has to go into the world. But when I make books, I don't think of that audience, if that it's sold in a shop or it's on my desk. And that's my only, at that time, my only reference. I never think of it, oh, it's going to be in a shop and people will buy it. That's not my main thought. Maybe if I would think of an audience and what the consequences are from what you're doing, maybe then I would do it differently. But I don't think that way. I think that's still maybe somewhere the artist or the painter who's acting like that. As a painter, you also think you want to do your piece. That's what you're doing. You want to get done what you have in your mind, and that's still what I'm thinking. And so maybe there's a little bit left of that thought of being an artist.
Yes, absolutely. So you graduated college in 1985 and began to work at the Dutch government printing and publishing office in The Hague. How did you get that job? How did you go straight from school to working in this giant government office?
Yeah, so I did only in the fourth year, I think, graphic design. And I was totally into Swiss typography. I thought it was really great. And so my teacher, I must say, was the chef, the boss of the government printing office design group. But he encouraged me to go to Total Design. And, of course, I went there, showed my work, and they didn't accept me. It's still...
They didn't accept you?
No.
They rejected you?
Yes.
That's astounding.
I showed work where I mixed sans-serif typefaces, and they asked me, do you do that more often? And I said, I do it all the time. I thought it was an advantage. Stupid me. Of course they don't like it. They used Helvetica, and only Helvetica. So it was really very innocent and basically yeah, not so smart of me to present that work. But on the other hand, it also, I realized that I was not accepted, that I did something that was maybe not normal.
What do you think, what was the biggest thing you think you learned from that rejection?
It's to think, what did I do? I realized that at that time in, so it must have been 83 or so, or 84, that I did something else than at that time people would do. And not that I thought, oh, I have to explore and experiment more. Not at all. But I thought, well, okay, my dream of Swiss typography was suddenly, it was gone. So it was maybe a mistake. I don't know. But anyway, so I told my teacher, they didn't accept me at Total Design. And then he invited me to come to his office, to the government printing office, because he had some belief. And he said, well, you can become a trainee at our place. And yeah.
Isn't it remarkable to look back at the arc of a life and a career and realize how certain people ultimately change the course of your destiny? And if it weren't for that situation, you might not be right here right now doing whatever it is you're doing. I mean, I think anybody can look back
and
see that.
But what's interesting that my teacher knew that was another teacher, Leuvelink, and that he knew how I worked, but that he invited me at this very strict government printing and publishing house, very strict, all these rules. And so maybe it was for him also good that somebody else was coming to this design group, and because there were all these old people sitting and doing their job for 100 years, and yeah, so maybe they need some refreshment. I don't know, but what he did, it worked. It worked.
What made you decide? What gave you the sense, aside from the possibility that he might have known that you were predisposed to behave that way? But what made you decide to break from those rigid rules of the organization and start experimenting? Because you did pretty quickly.
Immediately, it was very funny. You get a job, and because it's work, it's basically an 8-to-5 job. But I always started later. I lived in Amsterdam, and then had to travel to The Hague. So I also already with the time when I would come in and would leave the office, so at 12 o'clock at night or so, that was already the difference. And I took all the jobs nobody else wanted because I was the youngest, so everybody wanted to have the best jobs, the most prestigious jobs at the government printing office. And so I was always left with basically the trash assignments.
The dreck.
I think that was the big advantage. To do all these jobs because nobody was looking at it, so there was an enormous amount of freedom to work on these, sometimes silly jobs, just a cover or advertisements or something like that. So it was really something. I had all the freedom.
What kinds of things did you start doing? What were some of your very early experiments that we might not actually ever be able to see because, you know, it's in the annals of The Hague and some file cabinet somewhere?
No, what I did a lot was making these advertisements for stamp books. And it's like Wim Crowell, Karl Martens, Walter Nichols, all these famous designers from the Netherlands, they all made these books about stamps. And I did all these ads because nobody said, making advertisements, everybody said, oh, that's we don't do that. We want to make books. And of course, I also wanted to make books. And I did, but also these small jobs. But I really, because nobody was looking at it. So I spent a lot of time on it to make them crazy and beautiful. But that was recognized. So Oitje Oxenaar, the person who made our beautiful money in the 70s, 80s, with the sunflowers, and it's really beautiful. And he saw those ads, and he said, whoever made those ads should make the next stamp book. So that was fantastic.
And so you did. Book in 1987 and 88 really established your name as a force to be reckoned with. It was the Nederlands Poos Zekkels, 1987 and 88, two books in an extensive series about postage stamp issues. Now, earlier volumes were designed by Carol Martens and Vim Crowell. Were you intimidated following in the footsteps of these great designers that had already created these magnificent volumes?
Absolutely. I was totally in panic. It was really, I thought, what can I do? And first of all, I was always imitating them. I thought, well, maybe it should be Swiss typography, maybe it should be this. And I was really, it was terrible, terrible time to finally, somebody told me, a good friend said to me, why don't you do what you always do, what you're good at? You should do, don't be afraid, forget that it's such an important commission, and do what you always do. And that's basically what I did. The stamp books look like my exam at art school, which was about paper and about transparencies, and I made an exhibition about it. The way the books look are my final degree show at art school. Exactly.
Well, the design of the work actually pays no heed to the what was generally proper and respectable design of the earlier volumes. And I understand that both you personally, as well as The Hague, got quite a lot of hate mail about a stamp book. What was the hate mail about?
But first of all, it was surprising because I was working with my hair over my face. So
just you're very shy from what I understand.
At that time, certainly. So that to make a book that it had so much effect, it was really new, and that people would write ugly things about graphic design. I was totally surprised and maybe very naive. I must say I was very naive and also fearless at that time. But it was a surprise how, hate mail, now you think of email, but it was really sending letters by mail. And we received all these letters, and I have kept them all.
Why?
As evidence.
Of what?
Yeah, it's so, because when they came out, it was even it everywhere in the news. Everywhere they talked about these books that they were so crazy. So I also found out when you do something outspoken, that your position becomes very clear. So I suddenly had an enormous sort of people who loved my work, and an enormous group of people said, well, this woman must be crazy. And I didn't see the crazy thing. I didn't see it at all. I didn't know what people were talking about. I didn't understand. So maybe it's almost autistic. Mm-hmm. I really did not understand what was the big thing.
But did it impact your feelings about yourself or your work? Did you take it seriously? Did you begin to doubt who you were, your talent?
Absolutely. There was a lot of doubt. There was so much doubt. But on the other hand, I won all the prizes in the world you could get. People from all over the world would come to our design group to find this person, this designer who made those books. So suddenly there were international people coming to this very national design group. So something was happening. And people would invite me for lectures, and it was something special. But the other thing was that my colleague was in the jury of the best designed books that year. And he, of course, didn't like those books, but everybody in the jury liked them. And they said, it's something so new and so unexpected. So whatever it is, it should get an award. And then he agreed, but he called it a brilliant failure. And at that time in 88, when I heard it, I was so depressed about it. But I think he made a wonderful remark. It was a test, and it was maybe a mistake, but maybe it was a brilliant failure. So I really, in retrospective, I like very much his words. His opinion about design, it must have been a failure. I understand.
But why was it a failure if it was breakthrough, if it was beautiful, if it was original and innovative?
Yeah, but that's
that?
What we say now. But then it was not the case. But designers, colleagues were really, how do you say that?
Furious. Scared?
No, not scared. They thought, well, where this person suddenly comes up from nowhere, because I was always hidden in this design group, and suddenly there is this person who does these sort of almost avant-garde books.
Yeah.
So, and if you do something new, it's not accepted. So it's all later. And even myself, when the books came out, I didn't like them so much because I didn't design them as pages. because of the enormous pressure of time, I designed the books as press sheets. I did all the image editing myself, which was rare at a government printing office, because you would always get a pile of text and a pile of images, and by counting, now we have a Mac. But there you had to do a lot of administrative work to make a book. Right. And so, but those books were, it's like Massimo Vignelli always wonderfully mentions, it's BC, it's before computer. It's all by cutting and pasting.
Right after that experience, you decided to come to the United States, or shortly thereafter. You were hoping to live here and in New York City, and you went to all the museums. You went to MoMA and the Whitney and the Met in an effort to get work, and nobody would hire you. What happened? How was that even remotely possible?
They saw the work, but they didn't understand it. It was so different, really work from a different culture. And so all the books I showed were sort of experimental. I did an annual report for the Art Council in the Netherlands, which was totally a conceptual piece. They didn't understand it at all. And I regret, because everywhere I left those pieces, but where are they? Probably they were trashed. And they also said that my book covers had no image. And they said, we here in America like an image, because an image sell. And I said, well, I don't know. And I thought, well, why? And they also asked me, why you don't have images on your cover? So maybe I'm from the Netherlands, which is a small country, and culture is subsidized in our country. So it's not very commercial. So it's more, you make a book for best designed books, or you name it, but it was all subsidized. So it was a completely different situation.
So they didn't understand what you were trying to do?
No, they said, if you don't use images on the cover, we can simply not work with you.
And at that point, you were unwilling to compromise.
But I didn't understand. I simply didn't understand. And I also said, if all the books have images on the cover, then it's very good to have a book without an image, no image, because then it will stand out. But they said, no, a book cover without an image doesn't sell. So that was full stop. So there was no discussion.
And so you went back to Amsterdam. How did you feel about yourself at the time? Were you disappointed? You had all of this sort of provocation after the Stamps books, and now you went to the United States to try your hand at design there and were summarily rejected everywhere you went. How did you understand yourself in all of that?
I think it made a lot clearer what I was doing and from where I come from. And so it helped me a lot. So maybe I'm very an optimistic person. So what everybody said here, I thought I had to listen very carefully and do something with that. And so I realized that what I'm doing, I'm from another culture, and maybe it's good that I stay there and develop my skills and my profession where it's appreciated. And then I got also this last job I did at the government printing office was a book about the future of the world. John Cage, Robert Rauschenberg came, Marina Abramovic, Dalai Lama. And I made the very last book with an image on the cover, which Robert Rauschenberg.
Your sign-off.
And immediately,
but what about Robert Rauschenberg? He didn't like the cover.
He didn't like the cover of this book. And he said, I really love the book, but the cover is lousy. I used one of his paintings on the cover. And I must say, it's really a lousy cover. It's terrible. He was totally right.
What was lousy about it? How do you decide what's lousy and what isn't?
If you see the typography in combination with his work, it's really bad.
Really?
It's very bad.
What made you decide
it is in the little red book, so you can see it. But yeah, I don't know. It was something, because he was so important also for this event. And yeah, I thought, well, why not try it one time to use an image?
It didn't work.
It didn't work. But then the big sponsor of this whole event was a company, SHV, Paul van Vlissingen. And he liked the book very much. So I came sort of more or less, it's all in the same time, disappointed back from the US, from New York. But at the same time, I got this enormous offer to work with Paul van Vlissingen, who was a fantastic person, a very philosophical person, who also owned a huge company in the Netherlands. And I happened to work with him for 16 years. So it all came together. So I came back to the Netherlands. Imagine if I wouldn't had come back. Then I was not sitting here.
Well, I mean, what's interesting is after these various rejections, you get the opportunity to do something which on paper sounds kind of interesting, but also kind of difficult. But ultimately, you use that opportunity to change the world. And that is the design, the 5-year project to design a book commemorating the centenary of the Dutch conglomerate SHV. A 5-year project, 3 of which is research, which culminates in a 2,136-page history of the organization. I understand that you originally thought you'd need 4,000 pages.
Yeah, 5,000.
5,000.
And we really wanted to make a book which is a journey through time. And we needed a certain amount of pages to get that feeling. If you only have 200 pages, you cannot. Then it does not manifest that you want to do something like that. So we really needed a lot of pages, and so we wanted to have very thin paper. And so the thinner the paper, the more pages. And we found this beautiful paper in Japan, and we ordered it. And so in the end, it was 4,000, and when we said when we ordered the paper, they said, "Well, we're ready in 14 years," and it was only thing we didn't have 14 years. We only had 5 years.
Oh my God!
Yeah, it was terrible. It was terrible. Really. So we Johan Penop and I, who worked on the book, we immediately had to change our thoughts and reduce the content of the book.
Now, the book has no page numbers. It's a 2,130-page book without page numbers. There's no index, and you've described it as a book which is a journey, which is not from A to B, but from K to D. It's a book that is a real voyage. It's conceptual, highly conceptual. You have to find things. You have to discover things by happenstance, by coincidence. You've said that it's a book for the reader's mind, including doubts, mistakes, and changes. Can you elaborate on what you mean by that, for the reader's mind, including doubts, mistakes, and changes?
So it's all these questions. That's basically what you find in this book, questions. So that's and every question is a case study, and where it says, "Do you know your backside?" Actually, that's at the part where the company earned so much money in the beginning of the 1900s. That was also for us to find archival material. The book exists of only archival material of the company. And Jan and I didn't want to write something about the company because the company wrote its history itself. We thought it was interesting that a company who is so successful is so down to earth and always stay close to itself and they're modest. They're very modest.
Was it difficult to persuade or convince your client, which you prefer to consider commissioner, and we'll talk about that in a moment, but was it difficult to persuade your client to do something so provocative, so never have been done before?
I think that considering the person with whom we worked, so Paul van Vlissingen, he was this very philosophical entrepreneur. And when we got the commission to make something, he said, "Make something unusual."
That was the directive. That was the brief.
That was the only sentence he said. That's such a challenge. It's like make a prize-winning book. How can you make something unusual? So it sounds like a very attractive commission or assignment, but it's highly, highly provocative and
Absolutely.
Difficult.
It's like saying,
difficult.
Let's make something that's never been done before. Please go invent something.
Exactly. So that's a thing. And he gave us, of course, 5 years, which is extraordinary and very smart. So he gave us time to think and to rethink something. We thought, let's keep it simple.
It's the exact opposite.
Yeah, that's exactly what we did. Let's keep it simple. We only do what we think is important in our life, for Johan Pennepel and for me, what is important for us. We commit ourselves 5 years to this company, which we didn't even know. It's a trade company, super unsexy. So why should we do it? We only can do it if there's something in it for us. And that's basically how we approach it. What do we want to know from this company? And so basically, to keep it from our side simple but a strong idea, and we really sticked to that one concept. We didn't compromise at all. And I think that that's basically what you see. That's what the book is.
You have said that you can't work for someone who tells you what size of the book you should make. And size is something that you have to decide on. I think that your work for the Design Museum in Zurich is a marvelous example. They were very specific. They told you that they wanted a 148-page book utilizing 70 images. You ended up with a book that was 864 pages and ultimately put them on the map. If you hadn't created that book for them, they would not likely have the reputation that they have as a museum. How do you persuade somebody to go from – how do you inspire? Let's put it that way. How do you inspire somebody? How do you get somebody that says, we have a budget for 148 pages. You come back and say, no, it has to be 864 pages. And then they're like, okay, let's do that.
So I can tell you, it's a very courageous commissioner. So they were open for it. But what I do is, that's why I think a meeting, and imagine if I would say send a designer from Amsterdam over to Zurich, that wouldn't work. So I go to Zurich, I go to the meeting, and I sat with the editorial board around the table, and I told them the story. You asked me to make a book. Fair enough. Nice. I love it. I went to your archives. I've looked at it. I tell them about my research, about my work, and that my conclusion was to make something else. It's a book which is a manifest of who they are and what enormous collection they have. And so I explain it first, and then of course, I have a model made 100%, completely with all these images, not all, of course, but with a very convincing part of a structural part of the book made. And yeah, so that it's seeing and believing. I tell the story, but then I have to show. I immediately show what the idea is. And the interesting thing was that the editorial board was totally quiet. They thought, oh my God. They it happened, I think, what thought would happen, and they were really shocked. But then they said, we have to call the director of the museum. So, well, great. So I did the same thing. The director came, I told the story, showed the book, and he immediately got it. He said, that's it, we're doing it.
Now, did you show them one of your prototypes that scaled, the little tiny ones, or did you – now, and I mean really tiny, like 1 inch by 3 inches. Did you do a full size?
I did a full size because otherwise they had no idea what I was making. But when during the process, I showed small sizes. But the convincing, the meeting we had, that was 100% book.
Why do you make these miniature versions of your books? They're precious. They're jewel-like. They're stunningly beautiful. They take an enormous amount of work, I would imagine, to get something to be that small and be able to really express this, the true nature of the book.
Yeah, I make them as a tool. For me, I make many, many, many. It's simply a tool. I can see how image and text are distributed. And so it's easy, like an architect makes a model to oversee the building. For me, it's also, of course, the book is not so big, but it's, on the other hand, it's also to oversee exactly what is happening with the book. And so it helps me. And it's also because it's smaller, it's not so frightening. So it's really a working tool. It's nothing more that it's precious. It's nice, but that's not the idea at all.
So you're really building the book.
I do.
I don't want to say that you have a style, because every single book is so different. The one common denominator is that they're genius. but there's a lot of Irma Boom in the book. There is a very The centerpiece of the book has a certain level of expertise sort of embedded in it. And I read that after you designed the book for veteran graphic designer Otto Truman, I heard he didn't like it. He thought it was more your book than it was his book. And he objected and stated, it's supposed to be a book about me. And you stated, it is my book about you. And he didn't like that at all. So I'm wondering about your involvement, your interpretation, your sort of presence in a book. It seems to me that you have to give up some sense of control in order to work with you.
I don't think that I am present. It's a way of working which is present. It's not a person. Yeah, I make the book, of course. But if Otto Treumann makes a poster, I see an Otto Treumann poster. If Wim Crowell makes a poster, it's Wim Crowell. And it's the same. And maybe if you make a book, you have to do some research. It's not just, it is an object. It has pages. It has an history. So there's a lot to tell. And if people come to me, they don't have any more text and image ready. So I make the book. So a lot of times I decide, even some the writer, of course, a photographer, I decide a lot. So, of course, there is a certain style to create it. But I think that I myself, I'm not visible. Like in Otto Treumann's case, I think what I wanted to do is bringing Otto Treumann to the 21st century. And yeah. He was a designer. He worked 50 years in the 20th century. And I wanted to bring him to a new century with another way of looking. And of course, if somebody else would make the book, it would have been the book by somebody else. So the whole sentence that it's my book and not his book, I think it's our book.
Now, there is quite a lot of complaining in certain aspects of the design community about how much direction we have to take from clients. And in fact, a very dear colleague of mine referred to the situation and said, you know, I'm not a design waitress. I'm not taking orders.
Exactly.
Why do you think that that's happened? Why do you think that, I mean, there are certain people you commission to do a project and you kind of know that you're going to be able to maintain integrity in the process. There are certain agencies that maintain integrity in the process. The question is, why do you feel that designers find themselves in situations where they're being asked to compromise over and over based on what the client needs?
Yeah, so I think as a designer, you have to make that clear what your point is. So you don't have to act like that. And I think that's maybe also a bit culture thing, but you can say what your qualities are and that you're also an advisor, collaborator. I think you have to make your point clear. You don't have to compromise. I don't think that at all. So it's you have to come with a good idea. Of course, you have to be convincing, and I think if you have a good idea, if you have a good argument, I think you can come quite far. And if you have no argument, then you're lost, of course. But you have to know why you are doing things. You have to have an idea about something and a good concept. And then you can always have arguments with a opdrachtgever, with the commissioner. But I think you can discuss arguments or an argument. And so I would, like, for example, I would never discuss with a commissioner a color. That's so subjective. And I think if I use yellow for a specific thing, then I can most probably explain why I'm doing that. But basically, I think, well, that's something so much in my domain, that's a complete, they have to give me trust to do that. I don't, so if you go into that discussion, I don't like yellow, so let's do red. I think then you're lost. If that's a level of discussion, don't do it.
Why do you get depressed when you go to bookstores now, Irma?
There's so many books which could have been on an e-reader or an iPad. And then I think you see all these piles of books, and that makes me depressive. I think, well, we have the opportunity to use another device. Why not doing it? And if you make a book, then it should be a book where you use the elements of the book in a superb way, so that you have a reason to cut trees and print and to bind. I think really you have to think about why you make a book. I always reject a lot of commissions I get. I think 50% I simply don't do. And I advise them to make to go to internet or start a website, much more effective for what they want. And that makes me depressive that a lot of people think, oh, it's work, I just do the book. And you shouldn't. You should think what you're doing.
Somehow you constantly seem to be stretching the possibilities of what books can look like, whether they be the triple spine of James, Jennifer, Georgina, your marvelous book, whether it be the paper cut by a sledgehammer for your Sheila Hicks book, which is just is the most beautiful book ever made. How do you keep coming up with these ideas? Where do they come from? Whether it be, you know, paper from coffee filters or Bible paper or making your own paper. How do you find these ideas?
It's not finding. I think it's already there. It's what I make is always very intrinsic. It's always the solution is already in the assignment. So I stay very close to the assignment. And I must say, you say all these wonderful words, but I think I'm an extremely bad designer.
What?
I don't even think that I'm... No, not at all.
Irma, no. This is very misplaced modesty. That's not even remotely possible.
No, I stay very close to the subject, very close. And it's only one step further to think, oh, then I do this or I do that. So for me, it's so obvious almost to do it. And you don't believe it?
No, I don't. I don't. I think of the Chanel book, which is a completely embossed white on white, no ink.
Yeah, but that's like a smell you don't see, and yet it's there. It's the same with the book. The book is not there, and it's very present. So for me, it's the same. So I think for me, it has to be very clear, very almost blatant what I want to do. So I stay very close to what something is. I only make this translation.
Irma, how many books are you working on at the moment? How do you how many commissions do you take?
Usually 10 to 15
every year.
Yeah, I'm always, because it's a sort of flow, books are in different processes. And at the moment, I'm working on a book for Copy Hewitt, a collection book.
Ooh.
Yeah, nice, very nice. And
designing a book for a design museum, that's a tough one.
Yeah, that's like really everything design was also a design museum. So,
and is it true that you're also working on a 110-meter-long tunnel near Amsterdam Central Station?
That's already finished,
Oh,
yes.
So you finished that. So you're actually, you do work even beyond the book.
Recently, yes.
And
yes.
Do you see that you'll be continuing in that vein?
I love it. I must say, when I did the curtain for the UN headquarters, it was really difficult, but I made a grid. So I stayed again very close to what it is. But I like it, yes. But the book I'm working now on is Elements of Architecture for the Venice Biennale, directed by Rem Koolhaas. And I think that's such a challenge. Rem is a book lover, and I'm a book lover. So it's to talk about this book and what that book should be. I think that's for me at the moment a huge challenge and very interesting to work on.
If you were to provide young designers with one bit of advice about what it's like now to design books, design for books, design with books, what would you say?
I think it's only an advice for designing books, but I think you have to stay close to yourself. I think really you have to be honest to yourself. And then you're also honest to a commissioner, or if you're commissioned by somebody, you have to be very true to yourself. And I think that's counts for everything, and certainly for designers.
Carl Sagan memorably asserted that a book is proof that humans are capable of working magic. And I think that there is nowhere in the physical making of a book more akin to the making of magic than in your work, Irma. Thank you for being on Design Matters.
Thank you so much.
To find out more about Irma Boom, you can go to her website, irmaboom.nl. I'd like to thank you for listening, and remember, we can talk about making a difference, we can make a difference, or we can do both. I'm Debbie Millman, and I look forward to talking with you again soon.
Design Matters with Debbie Millman is recorded at the Masters in Branding Studio at the School of Visual Arts in New York City. It is produced by Curtis Fox Productions with technical assistance by Rainey Ortica. The show is published exclusively by DesignObserver.com. You can subscribe to this free podcast in the iTunes Store.
You're growing a business, and you can't afford to slow down. If anything, you could probably use a few more hours in the day. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate, no coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.